from the Sky News Centre at 6. Police say the suspect in the mass shooting at a US newspaper office had barricaded a back door and used a legally purchased pump-action shotgun. Five journalists were gunned down in the offices at the Capital Gazette in Maryland yesterday. 38-year-old Jared Ramos has been charged with multiple counts of murder and has been held without bail. Prosecutor Wes Adams says he's a danger to the community.
In assessing the evidence in this case, we brought to the judge's attention evidence that suggested a coordinated attack and the use of a tactical approach and hunting down and shooting the innocent victims in this case.
Fire chiefs want the army to extend its stay on Saddleworth Moor through the weekend to help keep control of blazes in the area. Flames from 7 square miles of land have blanketed the Greater Manchester region and beyond in smoke and ash. Ian Saxon is Director of Operations at Tameside Council.
This still remains a major incident and requires a large multi-agency response to support the work led by the Fire and Rescue Service. I think it's important to acknowledge all the support agency work that goes on. Some of that behind the scenes to kind of minimise the impact for the local community.
A court's ruled a former police commander will stand trial over the Hillsborough disaster. It's lifted a stay which prevented the prosecution of David Duckenfield. Labour's criticising the Prime Minister for failing to reach an agreement on the UK's future trading relationship with the EU. Leaders from the bloc are calling on Theresa May to offer more clarity following talks in Brussels. Water shortages are being reported around the UK as the warm weather continues. The first hosepipe ban is beginning in Northern Ireland. Elsewhere, consumers are being urged to reduce the amount of water they use. And in sport, Andy Murray says he'll most likely be fit to play his first round match at Wimbledon on Tuesday. He's been drawn with Frenchman Benoit Paire. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
On BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news is the new Conservative councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henley's Steve Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Prime Minister Theresa May stopped Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee from interviewing 19 of the 23 intelligence officers and staff involved with torture. The remaining four were not allowed to talk about any specifics of their operation, nor fill in any gaps in operational timelines. So who's in charge? Theresa May or MI5? The security services or the government? The up-and-coming NATO summit also. Why is Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg bricking it? And investigations into US military flying in cocaine from Colombia. One of the original authors reviews last year's feature film about Barry Seal, the cocaine pilot on the cocaine trade. The film is called American Made. And also hypno-programming for assassination. Is it really possible? Local journalist Tim Tate explains how it may have been used to kill US presidential candidate, or he was running to be a presidential candidate anyway, Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. Plus, in our series looking at the Israel lobby, former head of studies at the US Army War College, Alan Sobroski, charts the rise of the US-Israel lobby, the Anti-Defamation League, and the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, from zero back in the 1970s, and he examines the extent of their power to make the US armed forces and broadcasters fight their wars for them today. Also, the slave trade in Liverpool, Bristol and London pioneered the horrific triangular trade which led to the deaths of millions whose bodies were simply thrown overboard. But where did we get this business model from? We hear about the important part the Italians played. First the Roman Empire, then the merchants of the Venice city-state. Plus, as if that's not enough, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 7 o'clock. Well, I would say, I usually say, we'll have the two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com, but I'm not going to because it's just one word, really, which is hot. So helping us review this week's news is the new Conservative councillor for West Beyond Trim and Henley, Steve Smith. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
Can you just tell us a bit about yourself? What's your background? What got you interested in joining a political party and getting into politics?
Right. My day job at the moment is I work in the NHS. I run a group of GP practices over in South Gloucestershire. But prior to that, I ran a youth work charity, Young Bristol, here in the city for a few years. And I've been involved in various bits of community work, volunteering as a scout leader, as a school governor, as a volunteer blood bike rider for local charities as well. And as far as politics goes, I was never a politically active person when I was particularly young. I wasn't into student politics or any of that kind of thing. But I was always a bit of a geek, I guess. Whenever it came to elections, I would sit down and make lists and charts and weight all the issues and score the political parties according to how much I agreed with them on everything. And after a few elections, it occurred to me that every time I did that, I was ending up voting for the Conservatives. So I kind of decided at some point in my early 30s that I must be a Conservative then.
Why Conservative? What was it about the party that appeals to you more than, say, Labour or Lib Dem or whatever?
Yeah, a few things. I think I am at root a bit of a pragmatist. I'm interested in what works, what delivers results, not necessarily in ideology. And I'm also quite a bit of a libertarian, I guess is the word. I don't like the idea of the powerful state or any other organisation telling us all how we should live, what we should do, what we should buy, what we can have.
OK, well, that's called regulation. And we've had something called the bonfire of the regulations. Is that something that you're jumping up and down cheering about?
Well, I'm not really aware we have had a bonfire of any regulations,
have we? Certainly did around about 2010. Also, lots of the little organisations, quangos and things like that, were gotten rid of. But, I mean, I'm thinking about the most important part of the country or the world that needs regulating, surely, is our banks. Because without honest banks and honest bankers, the rest of society is going to get fleeced. What we've seen is, I mean, I'm not saying this is just a Conservative thing, but what we've seen is deregulation of the whole of the banking sector, allowing for example, the auditors to write figures in a balance sheet that don't actually mean anything, that they're not the real figures that a company's worth, for example. That there's a whole bunch of junk in those figures, and now we really don't know anyone we can trust, surely, in the financial system. It's not somewhere that most people would say they've got great trust in bankers anymore.
Well, no, just slightly more than politicians, I think. But no, I mean, I'm a libertarian. I'm not an anarchist. I'm not sitting here saying we should have no rules and no laws and no regulations. Also, I'm not a banker. You know, I'm not sitting here to try and defend whatever goes on in the City of London.
What about regulations to do with something you do know about, which is the NHS? Because, for example, when it comes to drugs, those big drug companies, they want us to have as many injections as possible. They want to sell those drugs at the highest price possible to the National Health Service. And obviously, if a doctor is going to prescribe something, then they are going to make money at it. So there is an enormous financial pressure on the whole system from the pharmaceutical industry. How do you do that without some sort of proper regulation?
Well, you don't, and there's plenty of regulation of drug companies.
But this is good regulation now.
Well, again, I'm not a pharmacist. I don't know the technical details of all of the drug regulation. But what I would say is I don't recognise. I work in general practice. I'm not a doctor, but I spend a lot of time with doctors, and I run their business for them, so I do know the financial side of it. And I have never known a doctor choose to prescribe something or not prescribe something because of the cost or because of any financial pressures. Doctors prescribe what they think their patients need.
Yeah, but there's pressure, isn't there, for things to be allowed to be used by the drug companies. So they'll say, we want this thing to give permission for this thing to be used. And it might not necessarily, they don't like necessarily sharing the information that they've got, the test information, with the public anymore.
No, I mean, where drug companies spend millions, billions of pounds developing new drugs, then yeah, they want to sell them and they want to get their money back. And if they don't do that, they won't have the millions and billions of pounds to spend on developing the next one. So, you know, they do need to be allowed to get some sort of return on that investment so they can make another one.
Is the NHS being privatised?
No.
Because a lot of people say it is. There's a lot more private businesses coming in to the National Health Service. Are you part of a private business?
Yes, I work for a GP practice, and like every all but a few city centre walk-in centres, every GP practice in the country is a private business, and always has been. So, yeah, if you call that privatisation, then yeah, I guess the NHS has always been privatised.
But it hasn't, has it? No, because it was run by the Department for Health, for example, and there were different systems for checks and balances on GP practices in the past. It's relatively recent with the new system. You're probably going to have to help me out here. Clinical commissioning groups, that sort of thing, where GPs themselves are commissioning services. In the past, they would be told, well, here's an option of services you can use. Now they're choosing for themselves.
Yeah, clinical commissioning groups are public bodies. They're not private. And they have GPs sit on their committees. And to be quite honest, the GPs are involved in the governance of the organisation. They don't have an awful lot of say in what it does day to day, because those GPs actually are busy working in their practices most of the time. But GP practices themselves, which is, they're not the same thing as the CCG. Each GP practice is a private business and always has been. GPs have never been NHS or Department of Health employees.
What about here in the city, Henley's, Westbury-on-Trim? Are you going to keep your library? We've heard this week, I think, that the libraries are going to be there in 2010 still, but we're not sure what will happen after that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we obviously campaigned in the by-election that I was elected in just over a month ago. Biggest issue in Westbury and Henley's was the future of the libraries. Both were under threat of closure from the mayor, and what he's come out and said in the last week, in fact the decision will formally be ratified next Tuesday at the cabinet meeting, but he's said it on the telly, so it's going to happen, that all this,
well, hang on, they said Hinkley C was going to happen. They said HS2 was going to, they said electrification of the, you know, you don't believe everything that the BBC tell you.
fair point. But given how much our mayor likes making decisions, which is not a lot, when he's actually made one and said it on the telly, I'd be surprised if he then chooses to go back on it. So assuming that gets ratified at cabinet next Tuesday, what he said at the moment is that he has effectively put on hold his closure of libraries until the next mayoral election, which will also be a council election in 2020. And at the moment, what he's saying is they will all stay open as they are now, same hours, same staff, same services, nothing will change.
So why was the threat in the first place to close them?
Well,
come on, Marvin, come on the show.
Yeah, ask Marvin.
We all want to know, but he won't. So there you go. Maybe maybe next year, maybe Marvin, when it comes to getting re-elected, maybe he'll come on our Hustings programme. But at the moment, he's not interested. He says he's too busy.
I think it'll be an interesting issue at the next, because he's obviously deliberately done this up to the next election in 2020 so that it becomes an election issue. Now, whether that's a good political choice of him or not, I don't know, but I think it's great for those of us who want libraries to stay open, because who is going to run for mayor in 2020 and say anything other than, yes, of course, I'm going to keep them open?
As a newbie, if I can call you that, Steve, what's it been like turning up at City Hall or the Council House, whatever you want to call it? Is it easy to assimilate the way it works, or is it a little bit cliquey?
Actually, I haven't found it cliquey at all. What I kind of expected, when you look at it, at politics from the outside, and particularly, you know, my first experience of it was running in an election when everything is very party political and, you know, we're on the blue team and everybody else is the enemy. I kind of expected that it would be a bit like that. And when you look at, you know, those of us that are sad enough to watch council meetings on the webcast and all that kind of thing, you see people having a bit of a pop at the other parties. The first time I met people from other parties was a training session that I went to in my first couple of weeks, and there were people there from all parties, and the main thing that struck me is actually we were all there for the same reasons, and we all actually got on really well with each other. We've got far more in common, you know, I think it was Jo Cox there, didn't she, far more in common than divides us. And actually, if there's any cliqueiness there, it's not really between parties, it's between elected councillors on one side and officers on the other, and it's a bit of a thick of it kind of situation.
Well, that's the swearing.
Well, I couldn't.
So, with your first introduction to the city council, is it fairly clear to somebody like you how it all works in there now?
No, I don't think it's clear to anybody how it all works. One of the things I had when I've had various induction meetings and training sessions and that sort of thing as a new councillor, and after that, actually, the council has been very good, and most, well, I'll say all of the councillors and the officers that I've met have actually been great and really want to help and want to be supportive and want to help us as councillors do what we're there to do. But anyway, I went in for one meeting with a senior council officer, and one of the things I asked for was an organisation chart, a picture of who does what in the council, how it works, what all the departments are and how it's organised. And the answer was, I don't think there is one. Nobody knows. And the only way you can find the people you want and understand who does what is, we're very fortunate within the Conservative group, we've got an office and a couple of staff that support our group, and they know everybody and they know everything. So I pick up the phone and I say, who do I need to talk to about trees or bins or roads or whatever it is? And they say, ah, go and talk to so-and-so. If those people weren't there, who just happened to know the right people, it would be impossible.
So, I mean, the council spends something like 350 million quid of our money, mm-hmm. Every year. Who's in charge of spending it, do you think? The councillors or the officers?
The officers. I mean, that's just a fact. It's... The budget.
Do they
is
play
set.
Their cards rather close to their chest? Then is that seems to be what you're implying?
They can do, and I think it varies. Like, you're going to find this in any big workplace. You're going to find people who are genuinely keen to support and work with councillors and make that democratic process happen the way it was designed. And you're going to find other people who think that councillors are a bit of an interference and best off kept at arm's length and kept in the dark a little bit, and then we can get on with what we're trying to do.
Because I've tried to get hold of chief executives in the past to come on the radio, and they've been a bit like Marvin, just completely reluctant, and they're not interested. I just think, you know, why can't you just walk into a studio here? That's the way I see radio, really. It's just the easiest way to talk to people. If someone has got power, wants to be elected, come and sit down and just tell everyone what you think they need to know. Otherwise, if you don't come in and talk, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I'm wondering, so what's your agenda? Who else are you working for? If you can't just chat to the public about what you're up to. I mean, that's what keeps a democracy going. Anyway, Martin, what do you think about this whole balance of power between the officers and the councillors? We elect the councillors, we don't elect the officers. They're the permanent government, a little bit like the civil service up in Westminster and Whitehall.
This microphone's a bit loud. Well, the real problem, of course, is that local councils over my lifetime have been stripped of powers that they used to have. In the 19th century, when Chamberlain was running Birmingham, he had the power to set up a gas industry, a water industry owned by the council, which completely revolutionised the lives of the people in the city. Then that is not really possible anymore.
Well, because Bristol City Council just created an energy company.
Yes, but
it's losing a load of our money, but they've done it.
Indeed, yes, but of course that's true. But at the same time, the cuts from central government, most of the money spent by local government isn't raised locally. I mean, that's why Chamberlain was able to do that in the 19th century, because the rates, which were a property tax, and he represented the property owners of the city, but he was able to dragoon them into line. You know, we need to have these things. You know, we need to have piped water, we need to have gas. And, of course, that was how these infrastructures were put in, was by municipal entrepreneurialism, if you like. But, of course, that's long gone. I mean, in many ways, probably rightly so, because it's just too dependent on local conditions. If you've got a national structure for things like water or whatever, then that makes more sense. But, nevertheless, since the 1980s and the Thatcher era, local councils, which were often in conflict with the government, the GLC was abolished by the government. I still live in London at the time. And there isn't the balance between central and local government's broken down, inevitably, because central government's got the purse strings. So the policy is basically determined there, and then the councillors have got to just fit in with that, inevitably. And that's a real paradox. It's a real challenge for, you know, Labour councils, which control all the core cities, is that they get elected to try and do the stuff the people elected them want them to do, and in actual fact they haven't got the resources. And what I'd like to hear more from Marvin is less how wonderful it's all going to be, and just tell us the truth about what we can't do, rather than tell us what we, you know, rather than making it all sound as if it's some kind of wonderful. I mean, this was the sort of George Ferguson approach, which is, you know, we're going to make a difference, and I'm sure it does make a difference, but it's at the margin, and you shouldn't. And actually, to be honest with you, I'll just finish on this point. Lots of Labour voters, and I knock on the doors of the Labour Party, they're very well aware of the limited power of the council, probably more aware than other parties' voters.
Well, it must seem sometimes, I think, to councillors like they're dismantling something. They're rather like official receivers. Anyway, Steve, we're going to talk about some national stuff now.
Okay.
And we just heard literally a few hours ago about the Hillsborough inquiry, that the match commander, David Duckenfield, is finally going to go on trial. This is 30 years after Duckenfield is now 73. He was a match commander in the 1989 FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest, when 96 Liverpool fans were fatally injured in a crush on the Terrace Pens. Now, we ran a interview with a former PR guy for the South Yorkshire Police. This is probably 3 or 4 years ago about this, who said that Duckenfield was under the table crying. He simply wasn't able to deal with the situation, and he wasn't issuing yours as he should have done to mitigate, to bring the ambulances in and to actually take control of the situation. But that's just an allegation. It might be heard in his trial, we'll see. But why has it taken 30 years, do you think? First of all, I imagine you agree with the decision to charge him, but I mean, why has it taken so long?
I honestly have absolutely no idea. When this happened, I clearly remember this happening. I was in primary school at the time, I'm afraid, so I wasn't really aware of the news and the background to it at the time. But from what I've read and heard since then, in the inquest that took place, I think it was early this year or last year, it certainly appears that the powers that be at the time, between the government, the media, the police, did effectively whitewash, cover up that situation.
Well, it's not really acceptable, is it, to have some people who are above the law? You know, there's also a suggestion of possibly Freemasonry being involved. There was one lodge up in South Yorkshire, apparently, that Duckenfield was a member of. And one can see that there is the possibility that behind the scenes, court cases are... I mean, we're also in a situation, aren't we? We're a couple of big inquiries going on at the moment. One is the Grenfell Tower inquiry. The other one is the child sexual abuse inquiry. It doesn't necessarily look to me as if it's right that people should have to wait so long. And one of the reasons that even this has even happened now, it might never have happened, was because of the absolute organised opposition to the lack of justice by people in Liverpool.
Yeah, that's right. And I think times have changed. I'm not saying we live in a perfect world now, of course we don't, but partly because of what happened over Hillsborough and the fact that it was covered up, kind of covered up is possibly a little bit strong, but the fact that it took this long and it took public pressure and political pressure from certain parties, certain people by that, I'm not getting party political about it, but it took that to bring this to light and to get that inquest happening, and that's now led to these charges and the trial that's going to happen. I think people in public life do talk a lot more about things like the Nolan principles of public life. You know, it was one of the first things I was sat down and told about when I became a councillor, and I've had it, you know, working in the NHS and being a school governor in other roles that I do as well. And I think maybe I'm a little bit naive, I don't know, I like to see the best in people, but when I work with people in various public roles, the sense I get is when they talk about those things, they mean them. And what I see when I'm working in these sorts of roles with people is people are serious now about openness and about transparency and about doing the right thing.
Well, we have the Chief Public Prosecutor from the the CPS on here about, must have been 18 months ago or so, and he certainly seemed like he was doggedly, his principle was, I don't care who it is. And then I said to him, well, what about the royal family? And he sort of blinked, because I'm not saying the royal family are a bunch of criminals, but it does create an area where people are potentially above the law. If you think about it, it's the Crown Prosecution Service.
That's Donald Trump's argument, isn't it? I can't be prosecuted. I can't have broken the law because I am the law. It's rubbish. And, you know, I'm a bit of a royalist, but if someone could bring evidence that, I don't know, Prince William was doing whatever he was doing, he should be prosecuted the same as anybody else should.
Martin, what do you make of Prince William's trip to Israel and Palestine this week? Because that's been quite the first time it's ever happened since the 1940s, when Britain recognised Israel.
Well, I mean, I think some people think it's a rather unfortunate timing because of you know, Trump just recognising Jerusalem as the capital and all the shootings in Gaza. But I presume it was probably arranged a long time ago. And of course, Prince William did the job he was asked to do, which is to talk to the Israelis, and he went to the Palestinians as well to show that you know, Britain is even-handed and all the rest of it. But I still question, if I was running the Foreign Office, I'd probably cancel that visit.
Why?
Why? Because the Israelis need to be taught a lesson. Why reward them?
Well, it's not rewarding them, is it? If he's going to talk to both sides.
No, because they definitely see it as being rewarded. You can see this by the smiles on their faces. That's how they see it. And if I was the Foreign Secretary, if Robin Cook was the Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, but you're not, Martin, that. You're not the Foreign Secretary.
I'm just telling you what
Martin,
would happen.
You're not the Foreign Secretary. No. And actually, Prince William, maybe he's got a bit of a Diana in him that wants
well,
to
no,
go,
but Prince William would have been sent by
going,
the Foreign Secretary. He wouldn't have made the decision on his own, Tony.
Going to these regions. Well,
it's not, it won't be his staff that will decide.
Look, I can tell you, Prince William is not ordered around by the Foreign Secretary. Anyway, Steve, what do you make of the visit?
I disagree, actually. I think it's a good thing that he went, and particularly that he went to both sides of the wall. And from what I saw of it, he was particularly even-handed, very careful to spend equal amounts of time on both sides, to talk to people on both sides, make speeches on both sides. I think that if, you know, that region has been a disaster zone for decades, and we can sit here and we can say, oh, well, it's the Israelis' fault, it's the Palestinians' fault, it's Hamas, it's the Zionists. The more we sit here and keep pointing fingers at the side we disagree with and trying to teach people lessons for behaving in ways that we don't like, the longer it's going to go on. And I think actually people like Prince William, he is not going to solve the problem that's been dogging everyone else for 50 years, but the more people like him go and talk to both sides and hear both sets of stories and get that on the news, the closer we're going to slowly inch to actually maybe solving this once and for all.
Yeah, I remember actually seeing, this is from about 20 years ago maybe, no, 15 years ago, in the Daily Mail, it said that Prince Charles was saying to the Americans that they really had to do something about the Israel lobby, Martin. That the royal family actually, you know, in a way, it's impossible for them not to get involved in some way in politics, isn't it?
You're asking me? Well, yes. Well, of course, they are part of the constitutional structure, whether you agree or disagree. That's why I say to you, it won't be the royal staff that will have decided on this meeting. This will have been coordinated with the Foreign Office, and therefore represents British government policy. I hear what's being said by Steve, I would suggest that, you know, we Britain needs to take a stronger line.
I thought it was
this.
The revolving doors from Chatham House that ran British foreign policy. Not the Foreign Secretary.
Well, it certainly isn't the royal family's staff. That's the point I'm making to you, Tony. They do not make a... When the Queen went to Ireland for the first visit since the rebellion in 1920...
This would be Prince William's decision that he wanted to go there.
I doubt that very much, Tony. I think that...
He's not ordered around by anybody.
Royal visits... He's the head of state of Britain, and the decision to send him somewhere on a royal visit like that will be taken by the Foreign Secretary in consultation with the Prime Minister.
You seem to be painting a picture of him as some sort of puppet that's ordered around. But anyway, can we just hear Steve?
I'm astonished, Tony, your lack of knowledge of the constitutional proprieties involved in these kind of visits.
That's the theory, but what's it in practice?
Well, in practice, Steve, it's all run by the CIA, but that's another story again, isn't it?
Steve, what do you make of this?
In terms of who organises, I don't know how this works, but I would suspect, the royal family is a tool that's available to the Foreign Office for Foreign Policy.
That's right.
I suspect that someone somewhere in the Foreign Office, whether it's the Foreign Secretary or whoever, would have suggested the idea of maybe having a royal visit.
Boris?
I suspect if William didn't want to do it, he wouldn't have done it.
That's
no,
possible
exactly.
As well.
Yes, that's probably, yeah. Also, coming back a bit closer to home, from we'll be talking about that, by the way, in the second hour, a real close look at the rise of the Israel lobby in the United States, mainly through things like the Anti-Defamation League and AIPAC since the 1940s. But we're going to look a bit more locally now at the stunning Garden of Poppies, which opened in Bristol to commemorate the centenary of the end of World War One. That's just I can remember a few years ago they were talking about the beginning of World War One. Apparently the anniversary is over now. Do you think that there's still anything to be learnt, Steve, from the lessons from the First World War nowadays? I mean, I remember we had Michael Gove saying actually no, it was a righteous war, and had a big battle on Twitter with various people, academics and things, and they were saying no, it was a waste of time. So what's your thoughts about, is there any relevance to the First World War today?
In terms of geopolitics as it stands today, probably not. No, I mean, the situation that led to the First World War does not exist today. But I think there is great value in things like these Garden of Poppies and other remembrance installations and ceremonies that go on, because they do remind us that wars are still happening today. They're different. They're not like the First World War. The situations are different, the causes are different, and the solutions are different. But ultimately, when we allow disagreement to dissolve into all-out armed conflict, the result of that is thousands, in the case of the First World War, millions of people lose their lives, and there's a real human impact to it. And I think that has relevance, for example, in the Middle East today.
Martin, was there any point in the First World War?
Well, I mean, basically, the arguments about the First World War are going to go on and on and on. There's always going to be a different take on it. I mean,
it just didn't seem to me that it really achieved anything apart from slaughtering millions.
I would probably agree with that, but I would also say that whether you agree with that or not, remembering what happened is important, whatever your view of it. And in many ways, of course, the run up to the First World War, the kind of, you know, people making belligerent statements without thinking through the implications of what they were doing and so on, that's actually got very strong resonances today, as you know, we see in international. You know, learning the lessons of that is, we still haven't done it. And of course, the whole Israel-Palestine dispute was started in the First World War by Britain's decision to, with the Balfour Declaration, to create a state in Palestine where there was hardly a Jewish population in place, which was rather odd. But it was what that was about was because of the Suez Canal was such an important part of the wasp waste of the British Empire, as it was called. They wanted a loyal little Ulster to prevent any other powers from approaching the Suez Canal. That's the kind of thinking at the time which led the British state to set up the Israeli state against the interests of the Palestinians and against promises they'd made
Israel,
to those people.
Israel's the other side of the Sinai to the Suez Canal.
Yes, but don't forget they just fought to, Britain had fought from Egypt into there, because the Sinai's not, you know, you go past the Sinai, you go up the coast road, don't you? So, in other words, that's the next place you come to. And, all of those things, you know, those things from yesteryear are still with us, yeah? Northern Ireland was created in the same era.
Large chunks of
Poland were taken off Poland and given to...
There was a big hoo-ha last year about the First World War, actually, in the Bear Pit. World War One. This is in November last year. We had a discussion, I seem to remember, on the very week with Mark Weston, your leader, about this, about a bit of artwork that had been put up, and it's a whole public art area which has now been closed by the council because of behaviour of homeless people in the area, although the homeless people were there long before the public art area appeared. And that was, the poster actually says, "Your king and country needs you for cold-blooded murder, crimes against God and man, to maintain the honour and glory of the British Empire." That's what the poster said. And it's actually a quote from a Bristol conscientious objector called Walter Ailes, who after the war went on to be an MP in the area. Now, this is simply a quote from a Bristolian who went went on to be an MP, and it seems as if it's led to such a hoo-ha in various way. I mean, I'm not saying that the present situation is because of this, but is that, do you think that's something that you should be complaining about if you walk past that and see it? I'll read it out again. It says, "Your king and country need you. Cold-blooded murder, crimes against God and man to maintain the honour and glory of the British Empire." Steve?
Yeah, if I remember rightly, that story, people complained they found the it was a poster or mural, I think, wasn't it? They found it offensive. They complained to Mark, and Mark went to the relevant officer at the council and got it removed. On that one, I disagreed with Mark. Sorry, Mark, if you're listening. But I think people are perfectly entitled to think whatever they want about a piece of art. They're entitled to find it offensive. I didn't particularly like it myself. But I don't think we have any right not to be offended. And I don't think we have any right to expect a piece of art to disappear or not to be seen because we don't like it.
Martin, this whole idea of being offended by one thing or another, now, there quite clearly, if there's something which is some kind of racially abusive or specifically personal about one particular person, they've got every right to be offended about it. Where do you draw the line on free speech and the right to be offended? Because it seems that there's more and more things people are getting offended about nowadays.
Well, I tend to a more libertarian view. I mean, people should be allowed to say what they want, but there is always going to be a limit to freedom of speech. I don't think that crossed it by any stretch of the
imagination. And what are your thoughts about what's happened with the Bear Pit? And now apparently it's everything is... Well, I was walking past through there the other day. All the artwork's gone. It's been painted grey, but obviously there are people turning up, or it's a sort of browny grey colour, and they're doing graffiti down there, as they've always done.
Well, I mean, I think it's disappointing because the People's Republic of Stokes Croft and all of those people, I think they had a sort of like mandate from the council to develop the area, didn't they? And it did. I mean, it did improve. I mean, basically, when I first came to Bristol 20 years ago, that really was a place you didn't want to walk through, and there was lots of people lying around, you know, obviously in distress. And of course, some of the churches up at Stokes Croft used to do a lot of work with those people. But it gradually became a more, you know, those people remained, but the place became more more user friendly. And it seems a shame that all the effort that's been put in over the years that they've been trying to improve it have just been cancelled by bureaucratic diktats, is what it looks like.
OK, now another story this week. More than 30,000 children aged between 10 and 15 say they're in gangs as fears grow of spiralling drug crime. There's an estimated to be around 70,000 youths involved with crime networks. Children are reportedly being trapped and groomed by notorious gang leaders. According to the study, criminals are using children to sell drugs in rural areas. Well, this is another milestone, isn't it? 30,000. We had one last week. I think it was to do with 4 million people on... We should do this every week, I think, have a milestone that we've crossed that week. Yeah. Last week it was 4 million on food banks. Mm-hmm. This week it's 30,000 children between 10 and 15, Steve, in a gang.
Okay. Are you going to tell me that's Theresa May's fault or Boris Johnson's fault?
Well, is it nothing to do with the rise in organised crime, in the lack of police, the cuts to the police, that sort of thing?
I don't know. Most crime figures... I mean, I was at my local forum in Henley's yesterday, last night, and the police were there telling us local crime figures, and every single category, I think, was down over last year. And whether you measure crime by recorded crime figures or whether you measure it by the British Crime Survey...
Well, this is, hang on, there's a big difference in poorer and richer areas, isn't there? There's a big difference. In fact, we looked at some maps last week of London, and you can see an exact correlation. The poorer boroughs of London have got an astronomical rise in crime. The richer areas are roughly stable.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a particular issue in parts of London. I don't think we've seen it particularly come to Bristol yet, but with knife crime and gang related, and that does seem to be linked, as far as I can see, with the not quite stopping, but the reduction in the use of stop and search. You know, stop and search was always a controversial tactic, but the figures would suggest that it worked.
Martin?
Well, I mean, this is the Daily Mail's figure. Where did they get it from?
Not the Daily Mail.
No, no. Well, where did they get it from?
Four other newspapers that have reported it.
Yes, but where did they get it from?
Right. Okay, so can you...
All right, I'm just questioning
in
the first place.
What I can do is I'll find that out, but yeah. All right. Let's assume for one moment that what this Daily Mail is saying is actually true.
All right. That's a big assumption. I'm sure you understand. I'll go with that. I think there's always been a problem with young people getting involved in crime, and... it's probably as bad now as it's ever been, but no worse necessarily. There tend to be panics about this once in a while, where we'll suddenly have a panic. It usually coincides with a new youth movement, like they're wearing different clothes or something, and they're scaring their elders. You know, the Teddy Boys would be a classic example from the 50s. Moral panics, they used to call them. I think there is a real problem with the illegality of drugs, because that then creates the scope for... I mean, it's a huge criminal enterprise, the drugs industry, and it inevitably draws people in. And, of course, the other problem has always been for boys with low levels of skill and self-esteem being drawn into these, dysfunctional setups. And I think one of the things that really has possibly made a big difference is the cut in youth work. I mean, you say you used to be a youth worker. I mean, the best way of avoiding this is to engage young people positively and not ignore them until they get into trouble with the law, and to give them lots of positive role models, sports, arts. I think one of the things that's kept Bristol relatively different from London is the opportunities for young people in Bristol are better. You know, there's opportunities to get involved in positive stuff. In London, it's less so.
Yeah, I was involved as chief executive of Young Bristol when the council changed its youth service, reduced the amount of money there. And what I said at the time was a mistake. Is that they took the money away from what we call open access youth work, which is effectively youth clubs and activities anyone can turn up to, and they put it into focused work.
Okay, so no, it's not. It took me about 2 or 3 minutes to find it. It's nothing to do with the Daily Mail, Martin. Nice try, but it's actually Anne Longfield, who's the Children's Commissioner. Her office has done this analysis.
Okay, well, a total
of 70,000 youths aged up to 25 feared to be part of gang networks. So there is obviously some sort of an increase here.
We've got the figure. The figure is 70,000. What was the figure last year or 5 years ago? Or, I mean, you know, 70,000 is a big number, but I don't know. Is that worse than it was?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's all just about lies, damn lies, and statistics. But it just seems to me that, particularly for young people, where their employment prospects are appalling, many of them, they're in debt if they've been to college or university, some up to £50,000, £60,000. The temptation to just go along and join a gang and make some easy money is enormous now.
Yeah, and I think the temptation to make money by crime, I mean, it's always been the case that nicking stuff is easier than earning it. I'm not sure if that's something that's changed. But in terms of employment prospects, actually, what I'm seeing as an employer is that even when I started the job I had now 4 years ago, it was relatively easy to recruit to roles that, to be honest, weren't paid a huge sum of money. These days, it is much, much harder because employment is rising. Unemployment, therefore, is falling. There are fewer people going after these jobs. There are fewer people available to employ. And what that's doing is it is pushing employers to improve their conditions, to improve their pay. And we're getting to a point now where employers are competing for people rather than people competing for jobs.
That's got to be a good thing, surely.
Of course,
I'm going to put a link up to that, sir, on our show page, not to the Daily Mail, but to the Times article. And it's just to clarify, it's 30,000 children aged between 10 and 15 and 70,000 up to 25. Also this week, we've heard legalising cannabis could be win-win for the UK, says... not the Daily Mail, but a think tank, the Institute for Economic Affairs, says criminalisation has failed and reform could create £1 billion in tax revenue. Margaret Thatcher's favourite free market think tank has called on the government to legalise cannabis. Martin?
I think it's a sign of the times. You saw William Hague also suggesting a similar thing not long ago. And I welcome this because it's the drugs industry is very destructive in, because of the dirty money involved in places like Mexico. The presidential election coming up in Mexico, and 123 election candidates have been assassinated during the presidential campaign by organized drug gangs. And in Latin America, across the political spectrum, people realise that it's the drugs themselves, harmful as they are not the real issue. It's the illegality of the drugs, which allows all of this dirty money to slosh around. The drug cartels basically bailed out the banking industry in 2009, according to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. And, you know, there's just no reality about this. I mean, it's not just about cannabis. It's about all
of it. I suppose
the
argument here, Steve, is a bit like the prohibition of alcohol in the United States, where, I mean, I'm always quoting this film, Key Largo, with Humphrey Bogart, where, the gangsters, Jimmy Cagney, I think it is, their biggest fear is that prohibition will end because that will cut out their untaxed income. And they're paying the police off over in the US, that is. I'm not necessarily saying, although they might be, that the police are being paid off by drug gangs who are here in Bristol. But that's a pretty strong argument. If the organised criminals are afraid of ending prohibition, maybe that's a good reason. Anyway, what's your thoughts about this particular one?
Well, you know, I didn't expect, as a conservative politician, to come and sit next to a left-wing economist and keep agreeing with you. But on this one, I do, actually. I think I sit as a magistrate in Bristol Magistrates Court, and 80-90% of the offences that we deal with in there are related to drugs. And it's not necessarily people being punished or being arrested or charged with the fact that they're taking drugs. It's the crimes they're committing, usually theft, to pay for it. And that has an enormous effect on the rest of society. But as far, you know, if we're going to start talking about,
I mean, that's another
issue. But as far as cannabis is concerned, I think you've got to accept we've been fighting this war on the so-called war on cannabis for I don't know how many decades now. I think there does come a point when you've got to accept that actually maybe we've lost here, and maybe actually we could do more to address the harmful effects of drugs and get some much needed money into the exchequer. If we did look at a different way.
I noticed that the Bristol police have done this little trial, haven't they, in the city centre, where you can take your drugs in and they will check their quality and they don't actually touch them. So if for some reason the police aren't arresting themselves for handling drugs, for passing drugs to them. But it does seem, I think, that we've got definitely...
Yeah, that was when they had a festival on, wasn't it?
Some sort of, reasonably enlightened approach in this city to that sort of problem. Anyway, let's go to Westminster now to... Prime Minister's questions this week, where Jeremy Corbyn was let's just hear what he had to say. He's obviously making a fuss about Brexit.
Why is it then that every Labour government leaves office with more people out of work than when they went in?
From a Prime Minister who presides over an economy where a million people are on 0 hours contract, that is very rich. She rules out a customs union. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister rules out a customs union, the Leader of the House rules out the Prime Minister's preferred option, and reality rules out a maximum facilitation model. That only leaves no deal, which he refuses to rule out. She is putting jobs at risk. Sadly, it's not those of the warring egos in her cabinet, because they've now been rewarded with an invite to a pyjama party at Chequers. Meanwhile, thousands of skilled manufacturing jobs and the future of whole industries in Britain are at stake. The Prime Minister continues to promote the fallacy that no deal is better than a bad deal. No deal is a bad deal. But isn't the truth that the real risk to jobs in our country is a Prime Minister who is having to negotiate round the clock with their own cabinet to stop it falling apart rather than negotiating to defend jobs of workers in this country?
Prime Minister!
I'll tell the Right Honourable Gentleman what I and this government are delivering. We're delivering a successor to Trident, stamp duty slash for first-time buyers, a modern industrial strategy for jobs and growth, action on childhood obesity, 1.9 million more children in good or outstanding schools, fairer schools funding, new technical education, improved mental health services, expansion of Heathrow, record levels of employment, record levels of employment, falling borrowing, rising real wages. We've triggered Article 50, we've agreed an implementation period, we've passed the EU withdrawal bill, a Britain fit for the future and leaving the European Union on the 29th of March 2019.
Yeah. Steve Smith, you're the new Conservative councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henleys, is it?
Yes,
Henleys. Yep. I'm wanting to say Henbury for some reason, but anyway. What's your thoughts on Brexit then? Is this all going to be a total disaster next year when we leave? Or is it all going to be fine and dandy? What do you think?
I don't think it's going to be a total disaster. I think if we end up with no deal, and it's not really 2019, it's the end of 2020, because although we leave the EU officially in March 19, the transition period means nothing much changes until the end of 2020. But if we get to that point and there really is no deal, and it's the EU, you know what people are calling this apocalypse situation, yeah, that will be bad. But it won't be a disaster. I don't, you know, we hear that there'll be no food in the shops and planes won't fly.
Is no deal acceptable?
No, nobody wants.
No one wants it, but is it acceptable? I mean, if say Theresa May comes back to us and says, "Well, I'm sorry, I got no deal at all," should she go? If she's not able to negotiate with Brussels, I mean, well, what's she doing in her job?
Yeah, and I think if that happened, and I genuinely do not believe that will happen. I don't think it's in anybody's interests for that to happen, and that's the important point. Is it's not, we're not supplicants here. We're not going to Brussels with a begging bowl asking for a deal. It's in everybody's interests to make this work. And I again, maybe I'm being too naive here, but I think pragmatism will win the day, and there will be a deal that makes this work. But if the worst happens and the whole thing falls apart and it fails, then yeah, I think the Prime Minister probably will have to go. But I don't think that's very likely.
Martin?
Well, I mean, it's been a slow burner, this, isn't it? I mean, when George Osborne threatened that there was going to be an immediate recession after the Brexit vote, that was over-egging it. There was an immediate fall in the pound, which then, of course, affected things like people's real living standards. And that's, you know, we went from the top of the G7 league to the bottom in terms of growth. And it's a slow burner. I think what the Airbus and the Society of Motor Manufacturers are saying this week is that if you don't get access to the customs union and preferably the single market, then we are going to take our business elsewhere. And of course, that's not an idle threat.
Okay, so what point is it in not manufacturing cars here? Because obviously, the people like BMW sell thousands, tens of thousands of cars here.
Yeah, but the supply chains for all of this have been integrated for many years, because we've been in
they're going into the UK and out of the UK.
Moment, without any checks on any of it. But once, if we go out of the customs union and the single market, everything will have to be checked going in and out, just as it is from Turkey Ukraine.
Actually, no, it won't have to be checked.
Why not?
There will have to be duty of some sort.
No, because you've got to fulfil. It's all about regulatory. You've got to follow the same regulations as the single. Norway has voted twice to stay outside the European Union. They're basically in the European Union all but name. They follow all the rules and regulations, including freedom of movement, and they've been asked twice, well, why don't you just join the European Union and then you can sit at the top table of everybody else? And for their own reasons, they've said, no, we don't, we'd rather just run our own show our own way. But they're still completely integrated into the supply chains that the EU has. Now, if Britain leaves without being in the single market or the customs union, then you won't be integrated in those supply chains anymore, and multinational companies will simply relocate, as Land Rover relocated to Slovakia, to avoid the problem of having all of these regulations different in different countries. That's the whole thing about the single market, all one set of regulations. We started off talking about regulation at the beginning of the hour.
All will be revealed eventually. Unreported by the mainstream press, this is Craig Murray, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, is that Theresa May's incredible obstruction of the Intelligence and Security Committee torture inquiry. They were only allowed to interview four of the 23 requested witnesses who were staff and officers of the security services, but then they weren't allowed to talk about the specifics of any operations or to fill in any gaps in timelines. Martin, this is almost unbelievable, isn't it? You've got staff at the MI5 and MI6, this is, involved in torture, and yet even the Intelligence and Security Committee have been stopped by the Prime Minister from interviewing 19 out of the 23 people that they wanted to interview.
Well, as you know, we had Ben Griffin on this show some years ago. He was an SAS guy who was in Iraq, and he was involved with extraordinary rendition, which is why he refused to go back. Britain has got very dirty hands here. We used to be, before we went to war with Syria, we were shipping people over to Syria to be tortured as part of and there's a huge gulag of Magna Carta was signed in 1215, but there are now thousands of people all over the world being imprisoned by our allies, the Americans, and presumably with our consent, who have no access to lawyers, etc. And of course, that is not just bad for the people concerned, it also gives a carte blanche to the security services to engage in the promotion of terrorism, as they have done in Syria, and then to say, hey, we're intervening in Syria to stop terrorism.
Well, Dominic Grieve is the chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, various other people on there, and I'll put a link to them on our show page, because these are the people who are supposed to oversee the security services, but it does seem as if they have got the idea that they can just do what they want and they will never be interviewed, they will never have to account for it. Also, there's something else called the Joint Intelligence Committee, which is just civil servants running the secret services. They get virtually no scrutiny. Their chairman is actually a local lad, Charles Farr. He was educated in Somerset at Monckton Combe School. We don't know very much more about him. He's simply a top civil servant. It doesn't sound as if there's a lot of accountability at the top level for these spooks, Steve.
No. And there are reasons why the Secret Service is secret. Of course, there needs to be political oversight, and there should be,
None of the officers and staff of the security services that have been overseeing torture, in fact, where we hear is in some occasions encouraging it, and actually this is a crime. But we also heard, didn't we, at the beginning of the year, I don't know if you saw this story, I'll put a link up to it on our show page, that MI5 are actually allowed to commit crimes. This is now official, apparently, that they can commit crime. So it doesn't seem that they're, I mean, what are they if they're not being scrutinised by MPs, and these officers can simply wring their hands and say, oh well, I'm not going to go in front of the MPs even if they want me to.
Yeah. Well, in fact, it's always been the case, certainly MI6. If you ever sit and read I think it's got the Security Act, the Act of Parliament that establishes MI6, there actually is a licence to kill. The Foreign Secretary can authorise MI6 to go and commit crimes, just in the same way the Defence Secretary can send soldiers to war. And sometimes, we live in an unpleasant world, and sometimes those sorts of things are necessary. But when it comes to, what we've heard this week, the revelations about British security services getting involved in torture, I try and put myself in the position of the people on the ground. 9/11 has just happened. There's fear, there's panic. You can maybe understand people stepping over the line, but there should be somebody up the line. That's why we have politicians to put their foot down and put a stop to that, and it didn't happen, and that was a failure.
And even now it's not allowed to happen, so I wonder if it's going to be 30 years again, a bit like Hillsborough, before anyone gets asked questions. Sorry, we're going to have to finish very, really quickly.
The fact that people aren't allowed to be interviewed by a public committee on television doesn't mean there's no political oversight.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, the new Conservative Councillor for West Beyond, Trim and Henley's Steve Smith. Join us after the news as we do our best to keep ahead of the curve.
Mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.